Oh, I love this one. The Next 10 Billion Years.
Oh, yeah.
Originally published the 4th of September, 2013. Earlier this week, I was trying to think of ways to talk about the gap between notions about the future we've been all absorbed from the last 300 years of fossil fuel progress, on the one hand, and the ways of thinking about what's ahead that might actually help us make sense of our predicament and the post-petroleum, post-progress world ahead, on the other. While I was in the middle of these reflections, a correspondent reminded me of a post from last year by peak oil blogger Hugo Bardi, which set out to place the crises of our times in the context of the next 10 billion years. It's an ambitious project, and by no means badly carried out. The only criticism that comes to mind is that it only makes sense if you happen to be a true believer in the civil religion of progress, the faith whose rise and impending fall has been a central theme here in recent months. As a sermon delivered to the faithful of that religion, it's hard to beat. It's even got the classic structure of evangelical rhetoric, the awful fate that will soon fall upon those who won't change their wicked ways, the glorious salvation awaiting those who get right with progress, and all the rest of it. Of course, the implied comparison with Christianity can only be taken so far. Christians are generally expected to humble themselves before their God, while believers in progress like to imagine that humanity will become God, or, as in this case, are able to pat God fondly on the head and say, "That's my kid." More broadly, those of my readers who were paying attention last week will notice that the horrible fate that awaits the sinful is simply that nature will be allowed to go her own way, while the salvation awaiting the righteous is more or less the ability to browbeat nature into doing what they think she ought to do, or rather, what Bardi's hypothesized new intelligence, whose interests are assumed to be compatible with those of humanity, thinks she ought to do. There's plenty that could be said about biophobia, the stark, shivering dread of life's normal and healthy ripening toward death, that pervades this kind of thinking. But that's a subject for another post. Here I'd like to take another path. Once the notions of perpetual progress and imminent apocalypse are seen as industrial society's traditional folk mythologies, rather than meaningful resources for making predictions about the future, and known details about ecology, evolution, and astrophysics are used in their place to fill out the story, the next 10 billion years looks very different from either of Bardi's scenarios. Here's my version, or if you will, my vision. 10 years from now, business as usual continues. The human population peaks at 8.5 billion. Liquid fuel production remains more or less level by the simple expedient of consuming an ever larger fraction of the world's total energy output, and the annual cost of weather-related disasters continues to rise. Politicians and the media insist loudly that better times are just around the corner as times get steadily worse. Among those who recognize that something's wrong, one widely accepted viewpoint holds that fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration will shortly solve all our problems, and therefore we don't have to change the way we live. Another, equally popular, insists that total human extinction is scarcely a decade away, and therefore we don't have to change the way we live. Most people accept one or the other claim, while the last chance for meaningful systemic change slips silently away. 100 years from now. It's been a difficult century. After more than a dozen major wars, 3 bad pandemics, widespread famine, and steep worldwide decline in public health and civil order, human population is down to 3 billion and falling. Sea level is up 4 meters and rising fast as Greenland and West Antarctic ice caps disintegrate. Fossil fuel production grounds to a halt decades earlier as the last economically producible reserves were exhausted, and most proposed alternatives turned out to be unaffordable in the absence of the sort of cheap, abundant, highly concentrated energy only fossil fuels can provide. Cornucopians still insist that fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration will save us any day now, and their opponents still insist that human extinction is imminent, but most people are too busy trying to survive to listen to either group. 1,000 years from now. The Earth is without ice caps and glaciers for the first time in 20 million years or so, and sea level has gone up more than 100 meters worldwide. Much of the world has a tropical climate, as it did 50 million years earlier. Human population is 100 million, up from half that figure at the bottom of the bitter dark age, now passing into memory. Only a few scholars have any idea what the words fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration once meant, and though there are still people insisting that the end of the world will arrive any day now, their arguments now generally rely more overtly on theology than before. New civilizations are rising in various corners of the world, combining legacy technologies with their own unique cultural forms. The one thing they'll all have in common is that the technological society of a millennium before is their ideal of evil incarnate. 10,000 years from now. The rise in global temperature has shut down the thermohaline circulation and launched an oceanic anoxic event. The planet's normal negative feedback process when carbon dioxide levels get out of hand. That's what I was talking about before in terms of the pink sky or whatever. That guy's right. The blue sky. Yeah.
Green sky.
No, green sky. Yeah, there's a book by that title. Today's industrial civilization is a dim memory from the mostly forgotten past, as far removed from this time as the Neolithic Revolution is from ours. Believers in most traditional religions declare piously that the climate changes of the last 10 millennia are the result of human misbehavior, while rationalists insist that this is all superstition and that the climate changes have perfectly natural causes. As the anoxic oceans draw carbon out of the biosphere and entomb it in the sediments on the seafloor, the climate begins a gradual cooling, a process which helps push humanity's sixth global civilization into its terminal decline. 100,000 years from now. Carbon dioxide levels drop below pre-industrial levels as the ocean anoxic event finishes its work, and the complex feedback loops that govern Earth's climate shifts again. The thermohaline circulation restarts, triggering another round of climatic changes. Humanity's 79th global civilization flourishes and begins its slow decline as the disruptions set in motion by a long-forgotten industrial age are drowned out by an older climatic cycle. The scholars of that civilization are thrilled by the notions of fusion power, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration. They have no idea that we were dreaming the same dreams before them, being further in our future than the first Neanderthals are in our past. But they will have no more luck achieving those dreams than we did. 1,000,000 years from now. The Earth is an ice age. Great ice sheets cover most of the northern hemisphere and spread from mountain ranges all over the world, and sea level is 150 meters lower than today. To the people living at this time, who have never known anything else, this seems perfectly normal. Metals have become rare geological specimen for millennia now. Most human societies have used renewable ceramic bioplastic composites instead, and the very existence of fossil fuels has long since been forgotten. The 664th global human civilization is at its peak, lofting aerostat towns into the sky and building great floating cities on the seas. Its long afternoon will eventually draw to an end after scores of generations, and when it falls, other civilizations will take its place. 10,000,000 years from now. The long glacial epoch that began in the Pleistocene has finally ended, and the Earth is returning to its more usual status as a steamy jungle planet. This latest set of changes proves to be just that little bit too much for humanity, No fewer than 8,639 global civilizations have risen and fallen over the last 10 million years, each with its own unique sciences, technology, art, literatures, philosophies, and ways of thinking about the cosmos. The shortest lived lasted for less than a century before blowing itself to smithereens, while the longest lasted endured for 8 millennia before finally winding down. All that is over now. There are still relic populations of human beings in Antarctica and a few island chains, and another 1 million years will pass before cascading climate and ecological changes finally push the last of them over the brink into extinction. Meanwhile, in the tropical forests of what is now southern Siberia, the descendants of raccoons have crossed the Bering Land Bridge during the last Great Ice Age and are proliferating rapidly, expanding into empty ecological niches once filled by the larger primates. In another 30 million years or so, their descendants will come down from the trees. 100 million years from now.
Million?
100 million years from now. It keeps going by a factor of 10.
Well, oh, I thought you said...
the last one was 10 million.
Oh, I thought you said 10 billion.
No. It's gone from 10 years it's gone 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years, 1 million years, 10 million years, and now this one is 100 million years from now.
Okay.
Retro rockets fire and fall silently as the ungainly craft settles down on the surface of the moon. After feverish final checks, the hatch is opened, and two figures descend onto the lunar surface. They are bipeds, but not even remotely human. Instead, they belong to Earth's third intelligent species. They are distantly descended from the crows of our time, though they look no more like crows than you and I look like tree shrews in the middle of the Cretaceous. Since you have a larynx rather than a syrinx, you can't even begin to pronounce what they call themselves, so we'll call them Corvins. Earth's second intelligent species, whom we'll call Scions, C-Y-O-N-S.
Or Procyonidae is the raccoon.
Raccoon Procyonidae, right. Mm-hmm. After their raccoon ancestors are long gone. They lasted a little longer than 8 million years before the changes in an unstable planet sent them down the long road to extinction. They never got that deeply into technology, though their political institutions made the most sophisticated human equivalents look embarrassingly crude. The Corvins are another matter, since some twist of inherited psychology left them with a passion for heights and upward movement. They worked out the basic principles of the hot air balloon before they got around to inventing the wheel. And balloons, gliders, and Corvin-carrying kites played much the same roles in their earliest epic literature that horses and chariots play in ours. As Corvin societies evolved more complex technologies, eyes gazing upward from soaring tower cities at the moon, the perch of perches set high above the world. All that was needed to make those dreams a reality was petroleum, and 100 million years or more is more than enough time for Earth to restock her petroleum reserves, especially if that period starts off with an oceanic and anoxic event that stashes gigatons of carbon in marine sediments. Thus, it was inevitable that sooner or later, the strongest of the great Corvin Kilth assemblies would devote its talents and wealth to the task of reaching the moon. The universe has a surprise in store for the Corvins, though. Their first moon landing included among its goals the investigation of some odd surface features, too small to be seen clearly by Earth-based equipment. That first lander thus set down on a flat lunar plain that a very long time ago, was called the Sea of Tranquility. And so it was that the stunned Corvin astronauts found themselves facing the fragmentary but unmistakable remains of a spacecraft that arrived on the moon in the unimaginably distant past. A few equivocal traces buried in terrestrial sediments had suggested already to Corvin lore masters that another intelligent species might have lived on the Earth before them, though the theory was dismissed by most as wild speculation. The shattered remnants of the moon confirmed them, and made it hard for even the most optimistic Corvins to embrace the notion that some providence guaranteed the survival of intelligent species. The curious markings of some of the remains, which some lore masters suggested might be a mode of visual communication, resisted all attempts at decipherment, and very little was ever learnt for certain about the enigmatic ancient species that left its mark on the moon. Even so, it will be suggested long afterwards that the stark warning embodied in those long-abandoned spacecraft played an important role in convincing Corvin societies to rein in the extravagant use of petroleum and other non-renewable resources, though it also inspired hugely expensive and ultimately futile attempts to achieve interstellar migration. For some reason, the Corvins never got into the quest for fusion power or artificial intelligence. One way or another, though, the Corvins turned out to be the most enduring of Earth's intelligent species, and more than 28 million years passed before their day finally ended. 1 billion years from now. The Earth is old and mostly desert, and its significant fraction of its total crust is made up of the remains of bygone civilizations. As increasing heat of the sun as it proceeds through its own life cycle, and the ongoing loss of volatile molecules from the upper atmosphere into space, have reduced the seas to scattered salty basins amid great sandy wastes. Only near the north and south poles does vegetation flourish, and with it the corbicles, Earth's 11th and last intelligent species. Their ancestors in our time are an invasive species of freshwater clam. Don't, and he has in parentheses, don't laugh. A billion years ago, your ancestors were still trying to work out the details of multicellularity.
Whoa.
The corbicles have the same highly practical limb structure as the rest of their subphylum, the 6 stumpy podicles for walking, 2 muscular dorsal tentacles for gross manipulation, and 2 slender buccal tentacles by mouth for fine manipulations. They spend most of their time in sprawling underground city complexes, venturing to the surface to harvest vegetation to feed the subterranean metafungal gardens that provide them with nourishment. By some combination of luck and a broad general tendency towards cephalization common to many evolutionary lineages, Earth's last intelligent species is also its most intellectually gifted. Hatchlings barely out of the creche are given fun little logic problems such as Fermi's last theorem for their amusement. And a huge majority of adult corbicles are involved in one or another field of an intellectual endeavor. Being patient, long-lived, and not greatly addicted to collective stupidities, they have gone very far indeed. Some 8,000 years back, a circle of young radical corpical thinkers proposed the project of working out all the physical laws of the cosmos, starting from first principles. So unprecedented a suggestion sparked countless debates, ceremonial dances, and professional duels in which elderly scholars killed themselves in order to cast unbearable opprobrium on their rivals. Still, it was far too delectable an intellectual challenge to be left unanswered, and the work has proceeded ever since. In the course of their researches, without placing any great importance on the fact, the best minds among the corbicles have proved conclusively that nuclear fusion, artificial intelligence, and interstellar migration were never practical options in the first place. Being patient, long-lived, and not greatly addicted to collective stupidities, the corbicles have long since understood and accepted their eventual fate. In another 6 million years, as the sun expands and the Earth's surface temperature rises, the last surface vegetation will perish and the corpuscles will go extinct. In another 90 million years, the last multicellular life forms will die out. In another 200 million years, the last seas will boil, and Earth's biosphere, nearing the end of its long, long life, will nestle down into the deepest crevices of its ancient, rocky world and drift into final sleep. 10 billion years from now. Earth is gone. It had a splendid funeral. Its body plunged into stellar fire as the sun reached its red giant stage and expanded out to the orbit of Mars, and its ashes were flung outward into interstellar space with the first great helium flash that marked the beginning of the sun's descent toward its destiny. 2 billion years later, the gas and dust-rich shockwave from that flash plowed into a mass of interstellar dust dozens of light-years away from the sun's pale corpse and kick-started one of the great transformative processes of the cosmos. Billions more years have passed since that collision. A yellow-orange K2 star now burns cheerily in the midst of 6 planets and 2 asteroid belts. The second planet has a surface temperature between the freezing and boiling points of water, and a sufficiently rich assortment of elements to set another of the great transformative processes of the cosmos into motion. Now in one spot of the surface of this world, rising up past bulbous, purplish things that don't look anything like trees but fill the same broad ecological function, there is a crag of black rock. On top of that crag, a creature sits, looking at the stars, fanning its lunicles with its sagittal crest and waving its pedipolyps meditatively back and forth. It's one of the first members of the world's first intelligent species, and it is, for the first time ever on that world, considering the stars and wondering if other beings might live out there among them. The creature's biochemistry, structure, and life cycle have nothing in common with yours, dear reader. Its world, its sensory organs, its mind, and its feelings would be utterly alien to you, even if 10 billion years didn't separate you. Nonetheless, it so happens that a few atoms that are currently part of your brain as you read these words will also be part of the brain analog of that creature on the crag of that distant, not yet existing world. Does that fact horrify you, intrigue you, console you, leave you cold? It's worth reflecting on that choice, and even more worth reflecting on its implications.
Well, I tell you, I reflect on those globular tree-like purple things. That's my sense of accomplishment. Wow. Not the next intelligence. So trees can continue.
The trees, right? Oh, my God, this guy's an international treasure.
That was awesome. I remember that essay, but not in that detail.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, and to have people read Ugo Bardi's 10 Billion Years, which is the techno-optimistic vision, and have people read this and just realize that both are possible visions. Which one do you think is more realistic?
Right.
You know, which one do you think is more grounded in primary reality?
Right, but the techno vision has to be not pie in the sky with no concern.
Right, exactly. The techno vision has to include that technology has helped us live in right relationship to the air, water, soil, and life.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Ecology.
Yes, that's why ecology is the new theology.
Techno optimists.
Yes.
Are fine to have do their thing and concentrate on what they do, so long as they accept that.
Yes.
And that there is a sense that we've been out of right relationship with the primary economy.
The primary economy of nature, right.
Nature.
Right.
And that none of the techno can possibly come into being without the basic quiet support of what we all have taken for granted.
Absolutely.
For too many centuries.
Yep.
And which our ancestors, however ancient they may be, never did.
Yeah.
They had the humility, necessity of humility.
Right. Yeah, that may be the fundamental stance toward primary reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. All the different religious traditions, when you look at just the postures of the human animal, the posture of kneeling, the posture of praying, the posture of palms open, the postures of hands outstretched, this is a posture of humility toward that which is greater than you.
Right.
That which is your primary source, your reality, your sustenance, your end.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of what Greer was doing with that last part is, well, no, you got to start
with the atoms.
You got to start off with the pulking chord.
Oh, right. This does the opposite of, for me at least, the opposite of John Polkinghorne's fear that in, you know, 20 some odd trillion years or whatever, the universe achieves heat death. Therefore, nothing is meaningful if you don't posit another worldly god.
Yeah. And so what that occurred to me was that in that final sequence,
the final sentence almost. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. With that creature in some other solar system somewhere with a newborn star, you can have the opportunity, if you wish, to think that there's a couple atoms in your brain right now that will end up in the brain of that
right.
pedipalp
whatever
creature thing there. And that's the opportunity to either... So it works either way. If you need to have, for your sense of meaning, that the species life cycle of the human or the planet life cycle of Earthlings, which culminates in that molluscan type thing, if you really, really need to have your sense of meaning dependent on that carrying forward, well, here he's throwing you a bone. You say, well, you know, a couple atoms in your brain right now yeah. could be on that other, you know, new solar system out there. Or he's giving you the opportunity to set that whole thing of immortality aside and find meaning in a temporal expression that does not require immortality to be a piece of it.
And yet it's all about continuation, continuity or whatever.
Oh yeah, well, cyclical continuity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cyclical.
Right.
The following blog post was written by Ugo Bardi on September 9th, 2012. It's what inspired John Michael Greer to write his version of The Next 10 Billion Years. So this also is titled The Next 10 Billion Years. He starts this way. It is not surprising that we found the future fascinating. After all, we're all going there. But the future is never what it used to be. And it is said that predictions are always difficult, especially those dealing with the future. Nevertheless, it is possible to study the future, which is something different from predicting it. It's an exercise called scenario building. Here, let me try a telescopic sweep of scenario building that starts from the remote past and takes us to the remote future over a total range of 20 billion years. While the past is what it was, our future bifurcates into two scenarios, one good and the other bad, all depending on what we'll be doing in the coming years. The past 10 billion years. 10 billion years ago, the universe is young. It only has less than 4 billion years. But it already looks the way it will be for many billions of years. Galaxies, stars, planets, black holes, and much more. A billion years ago, from the debris of ancient supernovas, the solar system has formed around a second-generation star, the Sun, about 4.5 billion years ago. The planets that form the system are not very different from those we see today. Earth has blue oceans, white clouds, and dark brown continents. But there are no plants or animals on the continents, nor fish in the water. Life is all unicellular in the oceans. But its activity has already changed a lot of things. The presence of oxygen in the atmosphere is a result of the ongoing photosynthesis activity. 100 million years ago. Plenty of things have been happening on planet Earth, starting about 550 million years ago, perhaps as a result of the ice age known as Snowball Earth. Multicellular life forms have appeared. First, only in the oceans, then about 400 million years ago, life has colonized the surfaces of the continents, creating lush forests and large animals that have populated the Earth for hundreds of millions of years. That wasn't uneventful, though. Life nearly went extinct when, 245 million years ago, a gigantic volcanic eruption in the region that we call Siberia today generated the largest known extinction of Earth's history. but the biosphere managed to survive and regrow into the Cretaceous period, the age of the dinosaurs. 10 million years ago. The age of the dinosaurs is over. They have been wiped out by a new mass extinction, caused probably by a giant asteroid which hit the Earth 65 million years ago. Again, the biosphere has survived, and now it prospers again, populated with mammals and birds, including primates. We are in the Miocene period, and the Earth has been cooling down over a period of several million years, possibly as a result of the Indian subcontinent having hit Asia and creating the Himalayas. That has favored CO2 removal from the atmosphere by weathering and has lowered temperatures. Ice caps have formed at both North and South poles for the first time in several hundred million years. 1 million years ago, the Earth has considerably cooled down during the period we call the Pliocene, and it is now undergoing a series of ice ages and interglacials. Ice ages last for tens of thousands of years, whereas the interglacials are relatively short, hot spells, a few thousand years long. These climatic oscillations are perhaps the element that stimulate the evolution of some primate species, which has developed bipedal locomotion. 1 million years ago, Homo erectus and Homo habilis can use fire and make simple tools. 100,000 years ago, the glacial-interglacial cycle continues, the hot spell known as the Eemian period, about 114,000 years ago, has been short-lived and has given way to one of the harshest known glaciations of the recent Earth's history. But humans survive. In Europe, Neanderthals rule, while the species that we call Homo sapiens already exists in Africa. 10,000 years ago, the Ice Age ends abruptly to give rise to a new interglacial, the period we call the Holocene. The Neanderthals have disappeared, pushed over the edge of survival by their sapien competitors. Climate stabilizes enough for humans to start to practice agriculture in the fertile valleys along the tropical region of Africa and Eurasia, from Egypt to China. 1,000 years ago, the agricultural age has given rise to the age of empires, fighting for domination of large geographical areas. The human population has been rapidly growing, with the start of a series of cycles of growth and collapse that derive from the overexploitation of the fertile soil. 1,000 years ago, the Western world is coming back from one of these periodic collapses and is expanding again during the period we call the Middle Ages. 100 years ago, the age of coal has started and has been ongoing for at least 2 centuries. With it, the Industrial Revolution has come. Coal and crude oil are the fuels that create a tremendous expansion of humankind in numbers and power. 100 years ago, there are already more than 1 billion humans on the planet, and the population is rapidly heading for the 2 billion mark. Pollution is still a minor problem that goes largely unrecognized. The concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been increasing to nearly 300 parts per million over the 270 parts per million, which has been the level of the pre-industrial age. This fact is noted by some human scientists, but the long-term consequences are not understood. 10 years ago, the fossil fuels which have created the industrial age are starting to show signs of depletion, and the same is true for most mineral commodities. The attempt to replace fossil fuels with uranium has not been successful because of the difficulties involved in controlling the technology. Energy production is increasing, but it shows signs of slowing down. The human population has reached 6 billion and keeps growing, but at reduced rates of growth. The Earth's agricultural system is in full overshoot, and the population can only be fed by means of an agricultural industrial complex based on fossil fuels. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere has been growing fast and is now at 370 parts per million. Global temperatures have been rising too. The problem of global warming has been recognized, and considerable efforts are being made to reduce the emissions of CO2 and other gases. Today, the world's industrial system seems to be close to stopping its growth, and the financial system has been going through a series of brutal collapses. The production of crude oil has been stable during the past few years, but the overall energy production is still increasing because of the rapid growth of coal production. The political situation is chaotic, with continuously erupting minor wars. The human population has reached 7 billion. The climate system seems to be on the verge of collapse. With the rapid increase in natural catastrophes all over the world and the near disappearance of the ice cap at the North Pole, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere is now almost 400 parts per million and keeps increasing. Then he has two scenarios, the future in two scenarios. First, the quote-unquote bad one, in which basically humans go extinct and the Earth starts to recover in 10,000 years, or actually 100,000 years, and a million years, the Earth is partly recovered, and basically by a million years ago, the Earth is, or 10 million years ago, Earth is fully recovered, lush, green and blue planet, full of animals and forests and carnivores and herbivores and blah, 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 blah. I'm not even going to bother reading that right now. I'm just going to go to the good scenario. 10 years from now, in 2020, fossil fuel depletion has generated a global decline of production. That in turn has led to international treaties directed to ease the replacement of fossil fuels with renewable energy. Treaties are also enacted with the purpose of minimizing the use of coal. The production and the use of biofuels is forbidden everywhere, and treaties force producers to direct all the agricultural production toward food for humans. The existing nuclear plants make full use of the uranium in the warheads that had been accumulating during the Cold War. Research on nuclear fusion continues, with the hope that it will provide useful energy in 50 years. Even with these actions, global warming continues and agriculture is badly damaged by droughts and erosion. Population growth stops and widespread famines occur. Governments enact fertility reduction measures in order to contain population. Nevertheless, the economy does not show signs of collapse, stimulated by the demand for renewable plants. 100 years from now. The measures taken at the beginning of the 21st century have borne fruit. Now, almost 1% of the surface of the planet is covered by solar panels of the latest generations, which produce energy with efficiency on the order of 50%. In the north, wind energy is used, as well as energy from ocean currents, tides, and waves. The production of renewable energy, electrical energy, keeps growing, and it has surpassed anything that was done in the past using primitive technologies based on fossil fuels. No such fuels are extracted any longer, and doing so is considered a crime punishable with re-education. The industrial economy is undergoing rapid changes, moving to abandon the exploitation of dwindling resources of rare minerals, using the abundant energy available to exploit the abundant elements of Earth's crust. The human society is now completely based on electric energy, also for transportation. Electric vehicles move along roads and rails, electric ships move across the oceans, and electric airships navigate the air. The last nuclear fission plants have been closed for lack of uranium fuel around 2050. They were not needed anymore anyway. Research on nuclear fusion continues with the hope that it will provide usable energy in 50 years. Despite the good performance of the economy, the ecosystem is still under heavy stress because of the large amounts of greenhouse gas emitted into the atmosphere during the past centuries. Agriculture is still reeling from the damage done by erosion and climate change. The human population is in rapid but controlled decline under the demographic pressure enacted by governments. It is now less than 4 billion humans, and famines are a thing of the past. With the returning prosperity, humans are restarting the exploration of space that they were forced to abandon at the start of the 21st century. 1,000 years from now. In the year 3000 AD, the ecosystems of the planet have completely recovered from the damage done by human activities during the second millennium. A sophisticated planetary control system manages solar irradiation by means of space mirrors and the concentration of greenhouse gases by means of CO2-absorbing/desorbing plants. The planet is managed as a giant garden, optimizing its biological productivity. The Sahara Desert is now a forest, and the thermohaline currents pump oxygen in the northern regions, full of life of all kinds. The solar and wind plants used during the previous millennium have been mostly dismantled, although some are still kept as a memory of old times. Most of the energy used by humankind is now generated by space stations, which capture solar energy and beam it to the ground in forms easily usable by humans. Research in controlled fusion energy continues with the hope that it will produce usable energy in 500 years. Humans are now less than 1 billion. They have optimized both their numbers and their energy use, and they need enormously less than they needed in the more turbulent ages of 1,000 years before. The development of artificial intelligence is in full swing, and practically all tasks that once had been in the hands of humans is now in the quote-unquote hands of sophisticated robotic systems. These robots have colonized the solar system, and humans now live in underground cities on the moon. The new planetary intelligence starts considering the idea of terraforming Mars and Venus. The first antimatter-powered interstellar spaceships have started their travel to faraway stars. 10,000 years from now. There are now less than a billion human beings on Earth who live in splendid cities immersed in the lush forests that the planet has become. Some of them work as a hobby on controlled nuclear fusion, which they hope will produce usable energy in a few thousand years. The new intelligence has now started terraforming Mars. It involves similar methods as those used for controlling the Earth's climate, giant mirrors and CO2-producing plants that control the Martian atmosphere, increasing its pressure and temperature. The terraforming of Venus has also started with similar methods, giant screens that lower the planetary temperatures, and immense flying plants that transform CO2 into oxygen and solid carbon. That will take a lot of time, but the new intelligence, capital N, capital I, is patient. It is also creating new races of solid-state beings living on the asteroids and orbiting around the sun. The exploitation of the galaxy is in progress, with spaceships and from the solar system now reaching a sphere, quote-unquote, of about 1,000 light-years from the sun. 10,000 years from now. About 500 million humans live on Earth, mostly engaged in art, contemplation, and living full human lives. Nobody knows any longer what controlled nuclear fusion could mean. Mars is now colonized by Earth plants, which are helping to create an atmosphere suitable for life. It is now a green planet, covered with oceans and lush forests. Several million human beings live there, protected from cosmic radiation by the planetary magnetic field artificially generated by giant magnetic coils at the planet's poles. The temperature of Venus has been considerably lowered, although still not enough for life to take hold on its surface. The exploration of the galaxy is in full swing. Other galactic intelligences are encountered and contacted. A million years from now. Venus, Earth, and Mars are now lush and green, all three full of life. Mercury has been dismantled to provide material for transforming the solar system into a single intelligent system that links a series of creatures. There are statuses orbiting around the sun, solid-state life forms living on asteroids and remote moons, ultra-resistant creatures engineered to live in the thick atmosphere of Jupiter and of the other planets. Humans living on the green planets have become part of this giant solar network. The other extreme of the galaxy has been now reached by probes coming from the solar system. 10 million years from now. The new intelligence is expanding over the galaxy. The green planets are now the place of evolution tests, and the Neanderthals now live on Mars, whereas dinosaurs have been recreated on a Venus where the planetary control system has recreated conditions similar to those of the Jurassic on Earth. 100 million years from now. Controlling temperatures over the three green planets of the solar system has become a complex task because of the increasing solar radiation. Mirrors are now not enough, and it has been necessary to move the planets further away from the sun, which is now the preferred system for climate control. The statites that form the main part of the solar intelligence now surround the sun almost completely in a series of concentric spheres. 1 billion years from now. The solar radiation has increased so much that has been necessary to move the green planets still further away. 1 year lasts now as 50 of the natural, quote-unquote, Earth years as they were long before. But these are no problem for the solar intelligence, just a small part of the galactic intelligence. The three green planets are three jewels of the solar system. 10 billion years from now, the sun has collapsed in a weak dwarf, white dwarf, and all the planets that orbit around it are now frozen to death. The galaxy has lost most of its suns, and the universe is entering its last stage of expansion that will lead it to become a frozen darkness. The galactic intelligence looks at a nearby galaxy. It is now the moment. The intelligence says, "Let there be light," and there is light. Exactly a year later, in September of 2013, Barty wrote another post called "The Next 10 Billion Years Revisited" in response to John Michael Greer's post. He begins with a quote from Marcus Aurelius. "Thou must now at last perceive of what universe thou art a part, and of what administrator of the universe thy existence is in efflux, and that a limit of time is fixed for thee, which, if thou dost not use for clearing away the clouds from thy mind, it will go, and thou wilt go, and it will never return." You can't understand a man's actions if you don't take into account that what he does on a specific day is the result of events that took place during his whole lifetime, and that will result in more events in the future. It is the same for a whole planet, although the lifespan of the Earth is much longer than that of a single human being. If we want to understand what's happening today on our planet, we must try to understand how it has changed over the eons to become what it is now, and what it may become in the future. That of looking at the whole span of history on a whole planet, or even of the whole universe, has a special flavor. Even though none of us will ever witness the end, the ultimate end of our biosphere, still the idea that we can imagine it is a source of great fascination. And it is not something new. It is a whole field of human thought that we call eschatology, from the Greek word eschatos, meaning the last. In the history of people musing on the ultimate end of everything, we can see two lines of thought that we might dub, purely for convenience, the Western and the Eastern views. The Western view sees the universe, humans, and everything as having a finite and limited lifespan. The Eastern view sees the same concepts as an infinite series of cycles. The single-cycle view is typical of thinkers steeped in the Greek-Latin tradition and of the monotheistic religions that arose around the Mediterranean area. In its basic form, the idea is that God created the world and that the world will have an end. Apocalypse, from the Greek word meaning revelation. Human beings are supposed to live a one-time trial. You succeed or you don't, but God doesn't give you another chance. East Asian thought seems to have been based on a different viewpoint. There is no end and no beginning to this endless cycle that the wise may, however, be able to interrupt. It's hard to say what factors created these two different schools of thought. One thing we know, however, is that today's Western science can be seen as a continuing of the ancient tradition, that of the single cycle. For what we know, the universe appeared in a specific event called the Big Bang and is destined to end, according to the most recent data, as a cold and dreary place made out of matter scattered over an immensely large volume. Back in 1956, Isaac Asimov was reasoning within this tradition when he wrote a story titled The Last Question, where he imagined humankind engaged in a forever quest for how to reverse the cycle and rejuvenate the universe. But Asimov was also thinking outside the Western box when he proposed at the end that the question could be answered, although not by humans themselves, but by the computer they had created. As there is nobody to tell the answer to, the computer proceeds to carry on the answer in practice by creating light and restarting the universe. I must have read this old story by Isaac Asimov when I was maybe 15 years old, and it inspired a post that I wrote on Cassandra's legacy with the title "The Next 10 Billion Years," for which I borrowed from Asimov the same finale. The post of mine had a certain success, and recently John Michael Greer, the Archdruid, commented on it and produced his own version of the next 10 billion years as he sees them. It is by all means a fascinating piece, but different from mine in a deep philosophical sense. True to his role of Druid, Greer explicitly rejects the Christian one-cycle tradition and leans on the multiple-cycle view of the universe, for instance, saying that 10 million years from now, no fewer than, this is a quote, no fewer than 8,639 global civilizations have risen and fallen over the last 10 million years, each with its own unique sciences, technologies, arts, literatures, philosophies, and ways of thinking about the cosmos, unquote. And then he goes on to describe several non-human civilizations arising and disappearing in the span of several hundred million years, including one derived from raccoons, one from ravens, and one from freshwater clams. There's no evidence in Greer's vision of the entropy-caused winding down of the universe. The atoms that once formed the Earth and its inhabitants are flung away in space by the last convulsion of the sun and end up forming another star and a number of other planets. The cycle restarts. As I said, we are discussing philosophical matters and we will never find an agreement on what the Earth will look like, say, 10 million years from now. So I'll just comment here on how science gives us a very strong evidence for a one-cycle Earth. With that, I don't mean just an apocalyptic end of our planet when it will be finally consumed by an expanding sun. No, the Earth has changed all the time over its last 4 billion years of existence. It keeps changing, and the changes are profound and irreversible. What we call the biosphere has been part of this great, long-lasting cycle. As all things that are born and are destined to die, the biosphere must peak and decline. Actually, it has peaked, and it is declining. The biosphere productivity over the past 3.5 billion years looks like a gigantic Hubbard peak, according to a paper by Frank, Bona, and von Baal. And then he has two very interesting charts. Figure one, this is the evolution of global surface temperatures, the solid green line. The green dashed line denotes a second possible evolutionary path triggered by a temperature perturbation in the Neoprotozoic era. Oh, I see. Okay, there. Okay. And B is the evolution of the cumulative biosphere pools for prokaryotes, red, eukaryotes, green, and multicellular life, brown. Okay. In a previous post, I wrote about this graph that, quote, as you can see, the Earth's biosphere, Gaia, peaked with the start of the Phanerozoic Age about 500 million years ago. Afterward, it declined. Of course, there is plenty of uncertainty in this kind of studies, but they are based on unknown facts about planetary homeostasis. We know that the sun's irradiation keeps increasing with time at a rate of about 1% every 100 million years. That should have resulted in the planet warming up gradually, but the homeostatic mechanisms of the ecosphere have maintained approximately constant temperatures by gradually lowering the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, there's a limit. The CO2 concentration cannot go below the minimum level that makes photosynthesis possible. Otherwise, Gaia dies, quote unquote. So at some point in the future, planetary homeostasis will cease to be able to stabilize temperatures. When we reach that point, temperatures will start rising and eventually the Earth will be sterilized. According to Frank et al., in about 600 million years from now, the Earth will have become too hot for multicellular creatures to exist. Of course, the extinction of the biosphere is not for tomorrow, or at least the calculations say so. But it is like estimating one's lifespan from statistical data. Theoretically, the homeostatic mechanisms that operate your body could keep you alive until you reach a respectable age. Sure, but homeostasis is never perfect. For instance, there are mechanisms in your body designed to reverse the effects of traumas. You may expect these mechanisms to work well if you are young, but if you are hit by a truck at full speed, well, you end up on the wrong side of the life expectancy statistics. Similar considerations apply to Gaia. Theoretically, the planetary homeostatic mechanisms should keep Gaia alive for hundreds of millions of years. But what about major perturbations, some planetary equivalent of being hit by a truck? Would Gaia be able to recover from a human-caused runaway greenhouse catastrophe? We cannot say for sure. What we can say is that we are living in a period called the sixth extinction, similar to other major past extinctions. In most cases, these extinctions appear to have been caused by an increase in the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The sixth extinction, too, is taking place in correspondence to a rise in the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that may never have happened so fast in the history of the planet. This rapid rise is also taking place under a solar irradiation that has never been so high as it is today. We can't rule out that the sixth extinction will be the last one. So that was all what he said about those charts. So as I said at the beginning, the present and the future of a single person can be understood from his or her past, and this is the same for the Earth, aka Gaia. Science is telling us very, very strongly that the present moment is unique in the history of the planet. The future will not be like the past. It is true that if we fail to survive as a civilization, there will probably be space for more human civilizations, and if we go extinct, there may be space for the evolution of new sentient species. But all that will happen in different conditions and along a different slope. New human civilizations developing within the next few hundred thousand years will not have the coal and the fossil hydrocarbons that we have consumed today. In a few hundred million years from now, new sentient species might find oil that has reformed in shallow anoxic seas, but they won't have coal, the result of very special conditions occurring only once, for all we know, on this planet. And they will live on a planet with a much reduced biological productivity in comparison to ours. That doesn't mean that they won't be able to develop spaceflight as Greer proposes. The future is full of opportunities, but it is never like the past. In the end, these considerations give us just a hint of the sheer immensity of the future and of how difficult it is for the human to conceive it. For what we know, we are a small ripple on the top of a gigantic tsunami wave that's crashing on some remote shore. As the ripple disappears, new ones appear, but the wave keeps rolling onward to its inevitable end. And yet, we know so little. There may be other shores, other waves. The universal sea may never stop to roll. The light and light and darkness may exchange places in a never-ending dance. So, just as Asimov concluded his story, someday the words, "Let there be light," may be said again, and there will be light again. And he concludes with a poem from Tao Te King, as reported by Ursula K. Le Guin. All-pervading, ever-moving, so it can act as the mother of all things. Not knowing its real name, we only call it the way. If it must be named, let its name be great. Greatness means going on. Going on means going far. And going far means turning back.